uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. Subti, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. Subti.com.
Fred. Hello and welcome to Fred Film Radio. I'm Amani Mohammed.
Fred Film Radio, sono Paolo De Marchi.
簡単にその先生の作品のあの紹介を
Fred Film Radio, Sundana Knight.
Clémence Ferry-Latour for Fred Film Radio, en direct du Festival de Cannes.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
You're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. The show is hosted and produced by yours truly, Matt Micucci. And this is a very special episode of the show for a couple of reasons. One is that this is our first episode back since our break to facilitate our extensive coverage of the Rome Film Festival. In fact, from the 14th to the 24th of October, we were in the Italian capital, live streaming and recording interviews with several guests who attended and presented works at Rome's annual celebration of movies. And by the way, we were also media partners of its parallel and independent section, Alice nella Città. And of course, throughout this very show, we will be honoring our coverage by hearing some of the content we produced there. But it is also a special episode of the Big Fred Tuesday because it marks the inauguration of a brand new segment titled Celluloid Heroes, where each week I aim to highlight a different person who left a significant impact on the history of film and highlight three films they made that may serve as a good entrance point into an exploration of their body of work. And for this week's inaugural segment, I have chosen to talk about the great American filmmaker John Cassavetes. Last but not least, we will also be kickstarting a remote coverage of Doc Leipzig by speaking with Alexei Lapin, director of Cry, a hybrid film presented there about life in a small village on the Russian-Ukrainian border that also posits the age-old question of the balance between art and commerce. I'll also return with another addition to our long-standing and acclaimed popcorn classic segment. So with all that being said, it is time once again to fire up that audio teeny and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air. This is the Big Fred Tuesday.
Fred.
Sean Baker recently presented his new film, Red Rocket, at the Rome Film Fest. Here's my interview with the American director from the Italian capital's celebration of movies. Check it out.
I guess the first question that I wanted to ask you is related to the term suitcase pimp. Is that a real term? And what is it that attracts you to this type of person?
Well, I didn't know about this term until I was, you know, doing research in this world and realizing that it's a term applied to these men, male talent in the industry that lives off of female talent in the industry. And what drew me in? I would say it was really getting to know these men, hanging out with them. On the surface level, they are charming and appealing and funny and entertaining. So I was actually enjoying my time with them, laughing, etc. Going home at the end of the night and letting everything they said sink in and thinking, why was I laughing at that? Huh, okay. And being very torn about my just my what I felt about these men overall. And so I wanted to actually tackle a character study that would put the audience in the same mindset and have the audience just as torn. You know, do I root for Mikey or do I want Mikey to go down in, you know, in flames? And so hopefully that's what I did. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. I absolutely. That's exactly how I felt while I was watching the film. A couple of things, too. I mean, just the setting of the film, too, I thought was just amazing. It's almost like you're stepping into a timeless place, you know, where time just moves differently. It's also profoundly American. Is that also important, the American part of the film here?
Well, yeah, obviously, you know, the oil and gas glass industry very important to the U.S. economy, but also extremely controversial, especially globally right now, you know, with the fossil fuel debate. So, you know, I also wanted to show that this is how people are living. These are livelihoods. And so not to take that lightly. So again, there was that balance of, you know, of different sensibilities. And also, I have to say, just as a director, visually, the refinery row is amazing. To have like the twisted pipes of rust and metal and steam and flames, quite visual. So it helped me in many ways have the location become a character.
Yeah. Well, it definitely did feel like it was important. Yeah. And just in terms of that, too, I also kept thinking of the concept of the American dream. Mm. It almost feels like the protagonist of this film still embodies that. And do you feel like that's still a thing, you know, the romanticized idea of the American dream?
I think at one time the American dream was simply about being happy, raising a family, and... and hoping that your kids did, you know, had a nice life. Yeah. I think that was just surviving was the American dream at some point. And now the American dream has been distorted and contorted into just a pursuit of like fame and money and power. And I think that I guess I'm tackling that, but I'm also tackling sort of like the unfulfilled American dream or the failed American dream, at least in the way that Mikey he gave up on that dream and he returns to a place he never thought he would have to return to and has to deal with that and cope with that new existence.
It's interesting to consider that also in terms of pornography and the role that it has played, I guess, to some extent, in a version of the American dream. Now the pornography industry is also radically changing.
That's what part of the reason why the film takes place in 2016, because there have been so many changes since then. I mean, with the rise of platforms like OnlyFans, sex workers, sex performers can actually just manage their own careers, and so it has definitely changed, and it will continue to, I guess.
I wanted to. This is the last question because I don't want to get anybody angry. I could talk with you forever, but Simon Rex.
Yeah,
what a fantastic performance! Yes. I don't think I've ever seen him better in a film. So
that's nice to hear. Well, he's amazing. I have had my eyes on him for like 3 decades because we're essentially the same age. So I've watched his peaks and valleys and his way of always tackling the next. Like he was a VJ back in the day. Then he was a comedic actor, a comedian, a rapper, and then he did great on social media. He always continued to entertain me, and I always thought, why hasn't he been given like a real meaty character? Like I would, and so when Red Rocket rolled around, I'm like, I guess I'm the one who's going to do it.
Sure.
And I'm so happy. I mean, he was so wonderful to work with. He's so talented, so motivated. Doesn't have that Hollywood diva thing at all. Like he came in and was ready for our crazy guerrilla filmmaking. I mean, it wasn't nice. It wasn't great for him. He didn't have a trailer. He didn't have, we were eating pizza every day. I mean, not Italian pizza, like shitty Midwest pizza.
Any donuts in the crafts table?
we said, we're all like, let's not eat any donuts. Let's be responsible. By the end of the last day we were shooting a donut hole, we were all eating donuts.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, Eddie, we got to go, but it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us. You're great.
Thank you very much, man.
Thanks a lot. This is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
Cinephile, it's time to inaugurate a new segment of the show, which will be split into 2 parts. The segment is called Celluloid Heroes, and will find me picking and choosing a different figure of film history each week. In the first part, I will provide you with biographical notes on the person, and in the second part, I will highlight 3 films that I feel are among the person's best or most representative works. For the first segment of the show, I decided to choose a man who I feel is one of the most important figures in American film history and one of its true independent artists able to elevate independent filmmaking to mainstream success. John Cassavetes was born in New York City in 1929 and passed away in Los Angeles, California in 1989. He was an American film director and actor, regarded as a pioneer of American cinema verite and as the father of the independent film movement in the United States. Most of his films were painstakingly made over many months or years and were mostly financed by his studio acting work, much of which was made for studios that were reluctant to back his own filmmaking projects. Cassavetes made his low-budget directorial debut in 1959. Shadows was made over a period of about 2 years and a half and shot on 16mm film stock. It was a semi-improvised, downbeat slice of cinema verite focused on three African-American siblings and their encounters with racial discrimination. It also had a jazz score by the great jazz composer Charles Mingus. While it won the Critics Award at the 1960 Venice Film Festival, it was only distributed in American theaters 2 years later. Cassavetes followed Shadows with more films that were determined and grounded in character development, depicting real-life situations with real-world consequences. His next big critical success was Faces from 1965, his first movie to prominently feature his wife and muse, Gina Rowlands. It earned Cassavetes an Academy Award nomination for his screenplay, while Lynn Carlin and Seymour Cassell were nominated for Best Supporting Roles. It's interesting to note that Cassavetes financed the film with the money he had earned in such major movies as The Dirty Dozen and Rosemary's Baby, the latter of which also earned him a nomination for Best Supporting Actor. In fact, John Cassavetes was one of the few filmmakers in the history of the Academy Awards to be nominated for directing, acting, and writing. And while never truly a part of Hollywood, he earned the industry's respect and admiration, and along with foreign influences from France and Italy, he helped shape the fabled New Hollywood period of the late 60s and the 70s. Other seminal works by John Cassavetes include Woman Under the Influence, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, and Opening Night, all of which came in the 70s. Aside from appearing in films directed by others, he occasionally acted in his own movies as well, including alongside Gina Rowlands in Love Streams from 1984. John Cassavetes lived life intensely, and the people who worked with him followed him loyally like a theater troupe. They included his close friends and collaborators Peter Falk and Ben Gazzara, as well as Gina Rowlands, always at his side. Their creative meetings and parties are legendary and earned him a reputation as a director maudit. He was always something of a functioning alcoholic, and towards the end, he was downing a bottle of vodka a day without ever seeming to be drunk. But the intensity of his life and his art eventually caught up with him, as he passed away just shy of his 60th birthday in 1989. Now, many claim that he was among the only true American film artists like Orson Welles and Martin Scorsese, the kind that would be associated with European filmmaking more than Hollywood structures and politics. That is all up for debate, but what is definitely true is that John Cassavetes left an indelible mark on the world of filmmaking and one of the most flawless filmographies of all time. Later in the show, I will revisit three of his works that I feel best represent him. But for now, let's carry on with the Big Fred Tuesday.
Fred Film Radio.
Joining us at this time is Alexis Lapin, director of a brand new hybrid film that is being presented at the time of recording at Doc Leipzig. Actually, Alexis is joining us directly from Leipzig, so hopefully you'll forgive the audio quality, which ain't great, but we'll see what we can do. Alexis, welcome to the Big Fred Tuesday. And let's get right into it. You are presenting your new film, Cry. But for the listeners who are not familiar with it yet, how would you describe your movie?
Yeah, the film is about, it's kind of a research. Yeah, it's a trip, like lost homeland. Yeah. Okay. Because I never, it's not really about my homeland, or I don't feel it like in this way. But I feel there is something that I lost somehow. And maybe this film was like this moment of research. What does it mean? Heimat. What is the meaning of homeland? Yeah. So.
All right, let me help you out a bit, Alexei, just for context. It's specifically a film that portrays life in a small village that lies on the Russian-Ukrainian border. And so having said that, how familiar were you with this type of setting?
Yeah, of course, it's a village where I spent some summers. I visit my relatives there, and I knew some people, and some people... which are now in the film are my relatives, like my grandma and my aunt and so on, yeah. So.
Gotcha, right. Because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, when you were a young boy, I understand that you and your family began moving to different countries, right? And I also understand that you studied with the great Mikhail Anika. Is that right? And what was your experience like?
Yeah, it's true. It's true, yeah. I studied there, yeah. It was, I mean, he's a great master, and he teached me somehow, yeah, he teached me a lot, actually, but not directly, but just with his way to be an intellectual and to be a filmmaker somehow, yeah, it was an important figure, I think, in my life. And of course, it was not. I could not. I know if he is the best teacher in the world, but he's a great master. And if he has this chance to be near one like a personality like this, it's a gift. Yeah.
Okay, so let's return to your film. Simple question: what is the meaning of the title? What's the meaning of cry?
Yeah, it's count. It's in Russian. It's controversial. This name Cry, because it's a landscape, but also border and edge too. So it's something like land on the border. Uh-huh. But and I think for me it's more border than land, because the film is about like how to deal with borders and how to go through borders. Because for me, cinema is also like a place where we can cross borders. It's a moment of crossing borders somehow. And I concepted this film also like this.
And speaking of borders, this village that you decided to film, you know, it really doesn't look like the type of place that gets seen a lot or documented in cinema a lot. And so I wondered, how did people react to your cameras and this idea that you were shooting a film there?
In different ways. I mean, we were so present there that we were at some point like the protagonists, and they were really curious, of course, and it was something new. And that's why this film also has this meta level, you know, like film in film. We just could not avoid it. And yeah, of course, people were... I can't say that they were super interested. It was actually no. We started to make a casting, yeah, like in the film, and nobody applied. Actually, it was quite difficult to let people understand that we are serious. Our intentions are somehow serious, you know.
Yeah.
It was crazy actually, because they started to have theories about our us, like maybe we are spies, maybe we are doing some business there. So they didn't trust at the beginning so much. it was strange for them that somebody is coming to make a film. Yeah.
And you anticipated my next question, actually, by saying that there is a meta level to this film that also concerns that age-old problem of the balance between art and commerce. So is that something that you yourself have also been concerned with?
Yeah, it's like this meta level was, as I said, it was something automatical. It was an automatical decision. We were so present in this village, we were so big, and everyone spoke about us, that we decided to cancel this difference between who is behind the camera and who is in front of the camera. And it was also important to reach some sincerity, right? And some directness between us and our characters. And it's a film, of course, which is dealing with film as medium and with predestination of this medium. How it's used and or what does it mean to use this medium for what for it's used now and what are the possibilities maybe, yeah.
And how do you feel you use the medium as a film director?
Yeah, for me it's a way to produce time and to capture time and to make a gift to the audience somehow. Because I also received a lot of gifts from other works, other films, which have inspired me, and it's kind of for me doing film is first of all dealing with something unknown, something that exists, but I can't describe it with words. I know that it exists, a feeling, and that's why I'm starting to make film. When I feel that something is there, but I can't describe it. It's so mysterious and unknown. And so I make a trip to this unknown place and hope to find something truthful. Something new for me and for the audience too. So for me, doing film is dealing with the unknown of this world. Yeah.
Yes. Alexei, this is a point that I'm going to want to return to later. So stay where you are. We'll be right back after this short break.
Fred Film Radio.
We're back on the Big Fred Tuesday with Alexei Lapin, and we have been talking about his new film Cry, screening at Doc Leipzig. And since it seems like you like discussing these kinds of things, I wanted to refer to something that happens in the movie and kind of get your thoughts on it. At one point, you film a conversation between three men who talk about movies, which may be an exaggeration, given that from what they say, cinema seems to have very little importance in their lives. So I wanted to ask you, considering what we said earlier, that the village in your movie is not the kind of place where cameras would go or where cameras would necessarily rush to document, what importance do you feel that cinema has in a place like this?
I mean, people are just living their lives. They're not interested in cinema. This scene, I like this scene a lot, and I placed him in this position because it shows somehow. I mean, I observe a lot of filmmakers which are taking themselves really seriously, like that we are so important and so on. But first of all, there is life, which is much more rich and much more intense somehow, and not intense, but it's the source of our ideas, the life, and that was the point. Yeah. And maybe this is this definition of unknown that I tried to say before, that it's there is something which we can't capture, but we can try it somehow. Yeah?
Yeah.
The essence of life. Yeah, it's like the mirror. You see the mirror, and but you don't see the behind. What is behind the mirror? Who is watching us? So for me, the camera or this film also was like a process to approach realities. This unknown. Yeah.
Well, let me throw a provocation your way then. Since you're always looking for this unknown, do you start your film project, and perhaps you could refer to this particular film project, Cry, Do you start it with some type of structure or idea of how you may be able to find this unknown?
I had a script. But I never wanted to reproduce a concept somehow, or start to make something that I know how it is already, or how it will be. It was not my intention to say something that I already knew. I felt I have to start to saying something in order to maybe to understand also.
And so how did you know when to stop filming?
How? There were practical limits or limitations, budget of the film and time of people of our life. So you can see, you can't, that was maybe the limit, but I also like it was when we started to shoot, we knew we have 30 days of shooting, and it was really really intense time somehow, and I just stopped to think too much, to be rational too much about what's happening. But I just moved, somehow I followed like my intuition.
So help me understand then, how important is the editing process, not only in putting the film together, but also in trying to discover this unknown that you are referring to?
Not really, because I shoot in this way that I shoot long sequences somehow. And I wanted to avoid to make the film in the process of editing, because I wanted to capture the rhythm of the village somehow, his essence somehow. And so we actually the film is in the film you have these scenes which are quite like short films, you know, but to get put it together somehow.
Yeah.
I started to edit the film during the filming. So I woke up really early and started to edit the film, and it was like putting pieces together of a puzzle. Yeah. And after editing, I would organize the shooting, or say what we have to do today. So
It almost sounds like you're using some type of sculptorial method, like a sculpture.
Yeah, like a sculpture. Yeah, you can say it. Yeah, yeah. It was it's sculpture. Yeah, you know, sculpture is like, I think Michelangelo or someone said, it's like a liberation of, you liberate a figure. A sculpture is liberated from a piece of stone,
I think what he said was that the sculpture was already in the stone, and it was up to him to reveal it. So why did you decide to shoot in black and white, because that also kind of reminds someone of sculpture, you know?
There is some reasons. First of all, because I like black and white, and it was like aesthetical decision. When you start to film, you have to make decisions, because everything is important, every detail is important, and also which format, what color, and so on. And then I knew that I could not control this level of colors. I could not control the colors, which could be symbolic, of course, or carry some meanings that I wanted to avoid, or distract our attention from faces, from this essence which I tried.
Yeah, I understand. And finally, this film is being presented at Doc Leipzig, but I feel like the term documentary may be too restrictive for Cry. Wouldn't you agree?
I was surprised that the film was selected here, because I never thought about these categorizations, and I never thought about my film as a documentary. I never had this idea, to make a documentary somehow. I just try to approach the truth. And of course, there's a lot of documentary elements, of course. But, I think that now, today, festivals like the Doc Leipzig, which is a traditional kind of documentation festival, are trying to smooth or destroy these borders of, or these definitions of what is documentary and what is fiction. So I think this is how the organization of this festival maybe see film in the future.
Okay, Alexei, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and sorry for the sound.
Fred.
Cinephile, we're back for the second part of our spotlight on the great American filmmaker John Cassavetes. Earlier in the show, I provided you with a brief biography of his life, but if you're not familiar with him, you may need some help in knowing where to begin your exploration of one of the most original voices in American film history. In that case, I would encourage you to begin with Woman Under the Influence from 1974, the intense story of a woman whose unusual behavior leads to conflict with her blue-collar husband and his family. The film finds lead actors Gena Rowlands and Peter Falk at their very best, and Cassavetes was inspired to write the movie when his wife Rowlands expressed a desire to appear in a play about the difficulties faced by contemporary women. The film's naturalistic approach makes it an intense and downright frightening and uncompromising portrayal of mental instability and characterization. And it is also one of the filmmaker's most accessible dramas, gripping from start to finish, to the point where by the end, the viewer will most likely be overtaken by a sense of emotional exhaustion. The next film I would suggest checking out is Faces, the first major success by John Cassavetes. Released in 1968, this movie stars John Marley and Lynn Carlin as a middle-aged couple in a disintegrating marriage, and particularly focuses on their one-night stand with younger people. Now, the film is characterized by lengthy sequences of tense conversations and confrontations, filmed in a disarming cinema verite style. It also had a significant creative impact on the works of Martin Scorsese, Woody Allen, and Robert Altman, and is often referred to as the movie that birthed the great American indie scene, preceding the birth of New Hollywood or the American New Wave, and the movies of such directors as the aforementioned Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, and Peter Bogdanovich, among many others. The third film worth highlighting in this beginner's guide to John Cassavetes is one of his final masterworks. Love Streams from 1984 not only shows that Cassavetes remained a significant figure in all three decades of his authorial activity, but also testifies to the importance of his creative partnership with his muse and life partner, Gena Rowlands, which can never be understated. In this film, they play two closely bound, emotionally wounded souls who reunite after years apart. The film is really daring and profound, mixing sober realism with surreal flourishes, revealing Cassavetes as a man unafraid to explore the full potential of cinematic artistic freedom, while never truly letting go of the naturalism that defines much of his creative output. While a few other films followed, Love Streams has not only been called an exhilarating inquiry into the nature of love in all its forms, but also the last truly personal work of John Cassavetes.
Fred.
Halloween has just passed, and whether you watched it or not, Halloween Kills was one of the big releases for horror fans this year. So, time to revisit my interview with its director, David Gordon Green, from this year's Venice Film Festival. Take a listen.
I actually watched Halloween Kills this morning, and like I was telling you before the interview, it was one heck of a way to wake up. I actually didn't have coffee, so it was actually good to kind of get that jump scare and wake me up there. I mean, I thought it was great. It was awesome. It's interesting how the Halloween saga sort of still feels fresh to this day, but I'm sure it must take a lot of work and creativity to keep it going, right?
Yeah, it's like everything. You're just trying to give the fans enough to find a fresh way to tell the story, but you can't totally resolve it. You know, it has to be a satisfying chapter. You have to have a beginning, middle, and end, but you want to leave some doors open so that you can come back for more. Because with this one in particular, Halloween Kills is the middle chapter of a trilogy, and so the idea would be to, with the first film, to establish these characters, or in some situations reestablish existing characters. This one, we just, it's anarchy, it's chaos, it's unleashing the entire ensemble, and then the Halloween Ends, which we'll do next year, is going to be about our narrative resolve.
Right. No, it's interesting. Yeah, anarchy, chaos. It's funny, while I was watching it, aside from like the gore and the creative ways in which people die in this film and all of the, you know, filmic aspects of the film, it's interesting how many of these scenes sort of really recall stuff that we've been seeing in the news. So, I mean, there is a real backbone of almost realism to what we're watching even in Halloween Kill.
And it's been particularly interesting because we finished this movie. We shot it 2 years ago. We finished it. I haven't even seen it. I'll see it tonight for the first time in since August of 2020.
Right.
So it's been interesting watching this year of headlines and world realities and chaos and division and to some degree some of that that mob mentality, but reflected in what we're hoping is great popcorn entertainment.
Yeah. But are you visually stimulated by stuff on the news and just everyday images that we see?
I always say that when people ask me why I would be interested in horror movies, or why do fans, what is it that people respond to about horror movies, is because I think every time you open the headline, they're engineered to freak you out and to screw you up and scare you. A lot of times, that's what they're doing. And so you take those headlines, and you're having your coffee, and you're reading what's going on in the world, and whether it's a worldwide tragedy or a personal demon or trauma that you're struggling with, they're isolated journeys. But when you go to a movie theater and you're with hundreds or thousands of people watching something, you can collectively scream and let it out. I just think it's wonderful exercise. It's just a way to release great
stuff, that energy and stuff that builds up inside of you even. It's interesting. It's interesting what you're saying. There's also a whole side to, you know, I'm sure that fans of the Halloween movies love the fact that, you know, you do pay tribute to the earlier works, you know, John Carpenter's original works. So I wanted to kind of ask you, when did you watch it first? Do you remember what it was like to watch the
first
original?
Vivid memory. I was at a friend. My parents were very strict and would not let me watch horror movies, in particular Halloween, because that was the crown jewel. That's what every kid wanted to see. But there were other, a friend of mine's parents weren't as strict as mine, and so I went over to his house one night, and I was going to sleep over at his house, and we were going to watch the movie, and I watched it, and I was so traumatized by it that I called my parents to come pick me up and take me home, because I was too scared.
It is a really traumatizing experience to watch it.
So that's what's fun about it now, is I get to like, kind of face my childhood fears, and I get to tell the boogeyman what to do.
Exactly. There you go. So, anyways, Jamie Lee Curtis returns in this film. She's also the Career Achievement Award winner, Golden Lion winner here this year at the Venice Film Festival. What was it like to work with her? And, what was it like to kind of have her back?
Well, she's a powerhouse and a force of nature and inspiring in every way. And I've just been a devoted fan her whole career, from Trading Places and True Lies and Fish Called Wanda, I love. And then I was just rewatching Terror Train recently.
It's a
Roger Spottiswood film, and just even reminded of like her humble beginnings, which is just so fun. And then to work with her, and she's fearless, and she's at work 45 minutes before she's supposed to be there. She shows up early and stays late and kicks everybody's ass in a wonderful way.
That's awesome. She's got a couple of iconic moments in this film too.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, well, anyways, we better wrap it up, but it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks very much for joining
us. Great talking to you.
Thanks a lot. This is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, we have reached the end of yet another episode of the Big Fred Tuesday, but not without a new addition to our recurring segment, an aid for cinephile explorations, if you will. This segment is titled Popcorn Classic, and each week I talk about a film that, in my opinion, is not talked about or not talked about as well as it should be. And this week I have chosen to highlight Mona Lisa, a brilliant and breathtaking British film by writer-director Neil Jordan, starring Bob Hoskins, Kathy Tyson, and Michael Caine, that was released in 1986. The best way to describe this film is as a journey into the dark heart of the London underworld by way of a gripping modern noir love story. Bob Hoskins plays George, a not-so-tough guy hired by a mob boss to chauffeur a call girl between high-paying clients. George becomes fascinated with this elegant lady, and his fascination leads him on a dangerous quest through the city's underbelly in a half-hearted search for a missing person that is full of danger, lies, and deceit. For his troubles, Hoskins earned an Oscar nomination, but Mona Lisa also affirmed Neil Jordan as a brilliant screenwriter with a penchant for colorful dialogue and a film director with an eye for evocatively surreal details. For this reason and more, I solemnly declare this unconventionally romantic tale of damaged people searching for tenderness in an unforgiving world, Mona Lisa, a popcorn classic. I give it five bags of popcorn and five cups of soda. And that's all for this episode of the Big Fred Tuesday. Join me again next week for more cinephile explorations, but don't forget also to check out more content on Fred Film Radio across our various channels and in multiple languages as well. Check out our YouTube channel and our recent coverage of the Rome Film Fest. Until the next time, stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the festival insider.
Fred Film Radio, this is Nicolo Comotti here at Venice Days.
Fred Film Radio, sono Chiara Nicoletti.
Angelo Acerbi per Fred Film Radio, on è al Festival di Venice.
Fred Film Radio, z vami sono Buon Protergi.
Fred Film Radio, radio filmowe Fred, z tej strony Anna Tatarska.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio,
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.